I called you my shiny black bass, to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this week
you're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Mass protests are scheduled to take place at the Republican National Convention to be held later this month in Philadelphia, and also at the Democratic Convention in Los Angeles next month. The conventions have been targeted by protesters because they are the forms of democracy without the substance, and our so-called public institutions do not function in the interests of the non-wealthy majority. Those in power will cynically promote our corrupt electoral process as the only acceptable venue for political activity. This is because the electoral system has been carefully controlled in a variety of ways to put corporations and capital first. Televised debates exclude all but the corporate-sanctioned candidates. Restrictive ballot requirements and winner-take-all elections are intentional barriers to transforming grassroots movements into electoral representation. The corporate press will not report on candidates with proposals that challenge corporate domination, except derisively. These institutions of government are, Professor Noam Chomsky will discuss tonight, the shadow that corporate capital casts over society. And who makes up the government? Michael Parenti will talk about who governs and what class interests they serve. In practice, any political demonstration or action where the participants attempt to thwart corporate power is considered criminal activity. The repressive police response to demonstrations in Seattle and Washington, D.C., and the preparations for more of the same at the upcoming conventions are part of a plan first created in the 1960s to preserve order by using military force to suppress dissent. We'll hear about that plan, Operation Garden Plot, in our second hour. And, as you will also hear tonight, even people who criticize corporations on the internet are now being tracked. Up next, Professor Noam Chomsky will speak on class war. Professor Chomsky is introduced by David Barsamyan of Alternative Radio.
The notion of class is usually associated with England, like the Masterpiece Theater series, Upstairs, Downstairs. The masters live on top and the servants down below. Class is rarely applied to the United States, where traditional lore has one big middle class with a few rich and poor on either end. Well, that conventional formula is dramatically changing. Powerful interests are waging a relentless class war that is eroding the middle. A 1994 Census Bureau report states that the number of Americans working full-time but earning less than a poverty-level income rose by 50% in the last decade. A study from the 20th Century Fund issued in April 1995 says that income inequality in the United States is worse than any other industrialized country, surpassing even Britain. Corporate profits are zooming, but working people are suffering. A recent Wall Street Journal headline says it all. Thanks, goodbye. Amid record profits, companies continue to lay off employees. A significant factor in the current economic situation is the virtual disappearance of unions. Without them, workers lack leverage in dealing with corporate managers. They're told to make concessions or management will either hire temps or move the factory to the third world. Noam Chomsky, MIT professor, is one of the foremost intellectual figures of this era. Rolling Stone magazine says that Chomsky has been unrelenting in his attacks on the American hierarchy. He's up there with Thoreau and Emerson in the literature of rebellion. The New Statesman calls him the conscience of the American people. A prolific author, his latest books are World Orders, Old and New, and Keeping the Rabble in Line. He spoke at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts on May 9, 1995. The meeting was organized in solidarity with locked out and striking workers at three major plants in Decatur, Illinois. And now, Noam Chomsky.
Fact is that to an extraordinary extent, by comparative standards, the United States is a business-run society, which means that human rights are subordinated to the overwhelming, overriding need of profit for investors. Decisions are placed in the hands of unaccountable private tyrannies, which means that even if formal democratic practices exist as they do, they're of peripheral significance. The government, in fact, is, as John Dewey called it 50 or 60 years ago, the shadow cast by business over society, so that modifications in the shadow are not going to change the substance. These were truisms throughout most of American history, including American working class history, until quite recently, until the 1950s, in fact. And it also means that social policy is geared to the transfer of wealth and power to those who already have it, and deliberately so. Now, in more democratic societies, by that I mean societies where democratic forms function more, there are countervailing forces that enable the public to enter the arena of policy and decision. That's only true to a very limited extent, a remarkably limited extent in the United States, despite quite impressive democratic forms. The country was founded on the principle that James Madison explained in the Constitutional Convention, that the primary role of government is to protect property from the majority. And so it remains to a remarkable extent. Well, one of the most effective democratizing forces has always been the labor movement, labor unions. The history on that is completely clear. In countries that have a strong labor movement, there is a very strong correlation with a real, live, functioning social contract that includes not only rights for working people, but for people who need help and protection, for the defenseless, for children, for women, for families, for people who need assistance generally, for the general public, in fact. And there's also a culture that goes along with it, a culture of solidarity and sympathy and mutual aid and support. In countries where unions are weak, like ours, we tend to find what's called tough love, as they call it these days, which means love for the privileged and tough for everybody else. We find what we might call, if we're honest, the really existing doctrine of free markets. That means market discipline for the poor and the defenseless, but plenty of protection and subsidy for those who really need it, the rich and the powerful. We find different psychological and cultural values, the ones that in fact were denounced by Adam Smith, whose motives were very much like those of the labor movement that developed later and very much opposed to those of the people who distort his message and shamelessly use his name. We tend to find what he called the vile maxim of the masters of mankind, all for ourselves and nothing for anyone else, now reaching its sharpest expression in the Gingrich contract, to which the population is overwhelmingly opposed, incidentally, point by point, by overwhelming margins, if you look at public opinion polls. But in a country where democratic forms don't function, that's basically irrelevant. And they don't function in large part because we don't have a civil society with organized elements, unions being the central one, as they have been historically, that can be a countervailing force. And that's historically been the case. Here as elsewhere, unions have been a leading force, probably the leading force, for democracy and human rights. That's true here as well. That's exactly why such enormous efforts have been undertaken in the United States in a really relentless and very self-conscious class war to undermine and destroy them. It's been going on for a long time. It peaked in the Reagan years. In the Reagan years, the United States simply rescinded Article 23 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which, if you read it, guarantees elementary human rights of workers, including the right to form unions. And this is well known, outside the United States at least. So in 1991, the International Labor Organization in Geneva did something that it very rarely does. In fact, so rare I can't even think of another example. Namely, it condemned the leading industrial power, one of its paymasters, which it shrinks from doing almost always. The ILO condemned the United States in the case of Caterpillar Company, for hiring scabs, what they like to call permanent replacement workers. And the ILO called upon the United States to adhere to international labor standards. At that time, there were only two industrial countries that violated them. One was the United States, the other was South Africa. Well, South Africa has changed since then, so we now stand in splendid isolation on that one. In 1990, every year the ILO, the International Labor Organization, comes out with a World Labor Report. The 1995 edition came out a couple of months ago. It shows that the United States has the worst record in the Western Hemisphere and in Europe in adhering to and guaranteeing international conventions dealing with labor rights and workers' rights. Actually, I'm exaggerating a little. El Salvador and Lithuania are a shade worse, so we're actually third worse in Europe and the Western Hemisphere. The United States does not even recognize standard conventions on child labor or on the right to organize. Now, what's particularly interesting for students and faculty and people like us who live in the Athens of America is that all of this passes without any awareness and any comment. Try to find some commentary on these pretty amazing facts about the United States. What you can find is just praise for our magnificence, as in, you know, leading the way to every wonderful thing. Well, the methods for subverting, I don't want to suggest that everybody is lying about it. Not everybody's in the universities and the corporate media and so on. Sometimes the truth is told, and it's very often told in the business press, which tends to be more honest and open about these matters, much less concerned about that their audience might get out of hand, I suppose. The methods for subverting Article 23 during the Reagan years were reviewed in a cover story in Business Week that I'd really recommend to you. I've written about it, but I haven't seen any other reference to it. It's a cover story in Business Week just a year ago, last May. Very accurate, very honest, as the business press quite often tends to be. Business Week points out that, I'm just quote some things to give you the flavor. They say, over the past dozen years, meaning basically since the Reaganites took over, over the past dozen years, U.S. industry has conducted one of the most successful anti-union wars ever, with a chilling effect. The purpose, they're very clear about the purpose. They say management's basic goal was to undermine the rights that were guaranteed by the 1935 Wagner Act, which brought the United States into the civilized world briefly. They were very quickly undermined. If there's time, I'll come back to that. Some of those rights are still guaranteed by law, but as Business Week points out, that's just a technicality. They don't make a comment on it, they just mention it. The basic method of this successful anti-union war was illegally firing thousands of workers for exercising their rights to organize. They point out that illegal firings increased by a factor of 6 for organizing from the late 60s to the late 80s, mostly during the 80s. Employers illegally fired Unlawful firings occurred in one-third of all representation elections in the late 80s. It's compared with 8% in the late 60s. And they quote a Harvard law professor who points out, even more significant than the numbers is the perception of risk among workers who think they'll be fired in an organizing campaign. And that's true. Any union organizer can tell you that. If the chances are that the employers will be able to simply fire people who exercise their legal rights with government protection, the risk of even entering into an organizing campaign, which is not small, there's plenty of sacrifices involved, as you know, that increases enormously. In this respect, this is very much like these radically mislabeled free trade agreements. It's a lot of talk about job flow and stuff like that, which nobody can estimate, and it's kind of a minor factor anyhow. The major factor is just the threat. The threat that jobs can move is enough to drive down wages and working conditions in the wealthier countries, and good behavior is meanwhile guaranteed elsewhere by terror and repression that American taxpayers pay for so that they can undercut their own jobs and harm plenty of other people, as well as by driving peasants into the urban labor force in third world countries by programs to force them into agro-export for American agribusiness, and by flooding the countries with subsidized U.S. farm products, what's called aid or food for peace by the more hypocritical commentators. Well, what all of this shows is that the famous slogan, crime does not pay, is a total absurdity, in particular when a criminal state is behind it, and that's crucial here. The Reagan state made it very clear that it simply would not enforce the law, so that was carte blanche to employers to just carry out criminal actions. It's a straight criminal conspiracy. I don't use the term conspiracy very often, but this was a very clear and open criminal conspiracy between the substance, corporate America, and the shadow, which was more of a shadow than usual, and just said, you know, yeah, go ahead and violate the law. We won't do a thing about it. Well, this illegal destruction of unions, Business Week points out still, is a major factor in lowering wages and in increasing the gap between the rich and the poor in the United States to Depression-era levels. It's reduced pension and health protection, and it's contributed to a 125-fold explosion in unlawful discharge suits. Why? Because the union protections that are guaranteed by law are gone. Similarly, safety regulations lapsed thanks to state employer cooperation in crime. The OSHA, the Occupational Self Safety and Health Administration, I'm quoting Business Week now, under Reagan and Bush, OSHA was a hands-off agency encouraging lawlessness. Along with the dismantling of unions, that state involvement in criminal behavior led to an increase in days lost to injury from 58 per 100 workers in 1983 to 86 per 100 in 1991, which again shows that crime pays very well when the criminal state is crucially involved. Well, there were other consequences. This is one factor in the huge growth in profits, the huge increase in profits and concentration of wealth, which is indeed reaching new heights. Meanwhile, real wages, which stagnated in the 70s, started a steady decline around 1980, and they continue to decline. They've declined right through the latest figures, right through the Clinton recovery, so-called. For people with a high school education, wages have declined well over 20%, somewhere around 20-25%. That's the source of this angry white male phenomenon that people are talking about. They have plenty to be angry about. Unfortunately, the anger is focused at the shadow, not the substance, but that's the effect of very efficient and massive corporate propaganda. But the anger is real and justified. For college students, wages didn't start dropping until 1987, when the Reagan reforms really got into high gear, and they've been dropping since. This is noticed. The Wall Street Journal had a big article about it in 1992. They pointed out that from 1985, the United States had the highest labor costs in the world, which you'd expect in the richest society in the world, should have much higher ones, in fact. But in 1985, as you expect, it would have the highest labor cost per unit output in the world. And in 1992, it was second lowest in the industrial world. Actually, in 1990, it was lowest of any country. But then Thatcher succeeded in smashing down the workforce in England even better than the Reaganites here, so the United States slipped back into second place in the competition to see who could harm working people more. So from 1985 to 1992, the United States went from highest labor cost to second lowest in the industrial world. And this was described by the Wall Street Journal as a welcome development of transcendent importance, as it is for their constituency. Business press, the rest of the business press describes other factors that are involved in this welcome development. The Financial Times of London, which is the big international business daily, they had an article about the same time about what was going on in Eastern Europe, and they described it as a horrible mess, everything's awful, but the headline said that there's some hope. The headline was green shoots in communism's ruins, meaning it's pretty bad, but there's some green shoots there, so some good things. The green shoots are what they described as the rising unemployment and pauperization of industrial workers under the reforms that the West is now imposing. And those are green shoots because it means that you can get workers in Poland, say, for 10% of the wages of the pampered Western workers. And as Business Week chimed in to say, that means it's a way to drive, that's another way, along with Mexico and, you know, Indonesia and so on. There's another tool now to force Western workers to abandon what Business Week calls their luxurious lifestyles. Of course, when GM moves to Poland or VW moves to Czechoslovakia, they believe in the really existing free market. So they demand very high tariff protections and public subsidies to pay them for doing this. Free markets, remember, for the poor. That's tough love, remember. Not for the rich. They get state protection. But this is a tremendous weapon against working people by now around the world. That's called the globalization of production. You can see why Harvard professors and, you know, Jeffrey Sachs and so on are so delighted about free trade. It's really great for the sector that matters. For the pampered Western workers with their luxurious lifestyles, may not be so great. And this goes across the board. So Daimler-Benz, Germany's biggest conglomerate, they can now move to Alabama, where they can get workers at third world standards with no labor protection and huge subsidies from the taxpayers of Alabama of exactly the kind that are given in the third world. And you can kind of whipsaw one labor force against another by these methods. That's another device alongside of the straight criminality of the state, as in the case of the Reagan years. All of this is well understood. Business press, let's go to Caterpillar and the Decatur strike. The business press has pointed out that Caterpillar, I'm quoting, is pursuing a business strategy that has nudged workers from defiance to compliance. Well, how'd they nudge workers from defiance to compliance? The technique was to build excess capacity in other countries, like, say, Brazil or Japan or Eastern Europe and so on, which means that when you have a strike in Decatur, you can supply your markets by overproduction elsewhere. That's alongside of hiring scabs and temporary workers and so on and so forth. Same is here. One of the big manufacturers left here is Gillette, and they have informed the business press that they are doing exactly the same thing. They're building excess capacity even in Germany, which has a strong labor movement, hence much better wages and much lower working hours and more benefits and so on. So they're willing to do that. They are not for profits, but for class war. So they'd like to have an excess labor capacity in high labor, high wage places for the purposes of class war, because as they explain, quite frankly, if there's a strike in Boston, they can supply European and American markets from their excess capacity that they've produced over there. There are other devices besides globalization and straight criminality to try to beat down the pampered Western workers. One of them was actually illustrated in headlines in the papers, Globe and the Times, 2 or 3 days ago, when they said bonds surge as unemployment rises and growth falls. If you read the papers, you notice right in the front page now, nobody conceals it, that the thing that is most worrisome is when unemployment goes down and growth goes up. But when unemployment goes up and growth goes down, then the bond market surges. And that's very important. There are by now like around $1 trillion a day that circulate around in currency markets, speculating against currencies. And they're looking for low growth low growth and low employment. They want stable currencies, meaning no threat of stimulation and growth. So they're delighted when the pampered Western workers are beaten down more and growth goes down and so on. This is a big change in the last 20, 30 years and a huge weapon in the hands of those who are trying to drive the world into a sort of a third world picture, including by now the leading industrial societies like us. Back in 1970, when this process began, before the deregulation of currencies, about 90% of the capital in international transactions was related to the real economy. It was for investment or trade. About 10% was speculation. Those figures have radically changed. By 1995, it was 5% related to the real economy and 95% speculation. That's a huge change. Besides which, the amount has just zoomed astronomically. That's why 25% of the corporate recruiters at MIT now are from Wall Street. They're going after hotshot PhDs in physics and math, who they don't know anything about business, but they just have to be able to figure out clever techniques for robbing people with all sorts of complicated scams. So you can shift money around, you know, every microsecond, a couple of billions of dollars, to undercut currencies here and there and so on. That's 25% of the recruiters right now, for physics and math mainly. The same thing's happening in England, incidentally. They're going after Oxford and Cambridge PhDs in math and physics. It was well understood by the late 1970s that this is going to be extremely harmful to the international economy. James Tobin, who's a Yale University Nobel Prize-winning economist, gave a presidential address to the American Economic Association back in 1978, in which he pointed out that unless something's done to slow down these financial transactions, it's going to drive the world into a low-wage, low-growth, and though he didn't say it, high-profit equilibrium. And that's exactly what's happening, and it's being stimulated. Social policy is deliberately designed to increase state criminality to crush the efforts of working people to organize and to make globalization of production easier so you can drive down wages everywhere by just playing one workforce against another. So it's being designed to stimulate these flows in the interests of what makes sense if you're in the top fraction of, you know, a tiny fraction of the world's population. Low growth, low wages, and very high profits. So the Caterpillar business strategy is indeed driving people from defiance to compliance and will continue to if it's allowed to. There are other factors too. Take, say, automation, which is putting plenty of people out of work. A lot of that actually, some of it was designed here in machine tools and so on. It's alleged that automation is, results just from market forces. So, you know, you can't stop it like the force of nature. But that's complete nonsense. The topic was studied in depth by David Noble here, no longer here, incidentally, partly for this reason. He's teaching in Canada now. But he did the main studies on what actually happened in developing numerical processing and other automation techniques. And what actually happened, in fact, is that it was so inefficient that it couldn't be done through market forces, and it had to be done through the state system. We have a huge state industrial system in the United States called the Pentagon. MIT is a small part of it, you know, way out at the periphery. But it's a technique for funneling taxpayer funds to high technology industry. And automation was developed within the state system for decades, in fact, in the Navy and the Air Force and so on, where cost doesn't matter because the taxpayer's paying for it anyway. And it was designed in very specific ways, not to be efficient, not for economic efficiency, but for control and power. As far as the automation technology is concerned, it could be used to put decision-making power and control into the hands of skilled machinists and get rid of managers. Technology is perfectly happy to be used that way. Or it can be used to de-skill machinists, increase levels of management. Yeah, the technology is happy that way, too. It doesn't care. That's the way it was designed. And it was designed as a weapon of class war through the state system because it couldn't possibly be done through market forces because of its inefficiency. That's true of containerization. It's true of machine tools. In fact, it's true across the board. It's even true of computers. These are among the huge mechanisms of social policy that are used to ensure that the pampered Western workers have to give up their luxurious lifestyles. And the effects are pretty dramatic. The one effect is just a vast move towards a kind of totalitarian system in which highly concentrated, unaccountable private power determines what goes on. Nobody has a word to say about it, and for the most part, nobody knows anything about it. And the effects are very obvious, just in the numbers. Every year, Fortune magazine comes out with a big thing on the Fortune 500. Now, this year is a particularly interesting one because this is the 40th anniversary, so a big celebration of the Fortune 500. The May 15th issue is worth looking at. I don't know if you recall, but some years back, Abby Hoffman wrote a book called Steal This Book, and that's what you ought to do with a Fortune 500. Don't pay them $4.50 for it or whatever it costs. But if you can pick it up somewhere, it's worth looking at. Very big, fat, glossy volume, which is quite intriguing. In the last years, for 1994, which discussed 1993, they described 1993 as a dazzling year for corporate profits, even though sales growth was stagnant. So you're not selling anything, but they're making huge amounts of money. 1994 was far better. They say profits went up a stunning 54% on a sales growth of 8% and employee growth of 2.6%. You just listen to those numbers and you see a lot about the world. Profits up a stunning 54%, sales growth 8%, meaning virtually no change, and employee growth 2.6%. You know, that doesn't exist. The numbers are revealing and they mean something. And concentration has gone up too. The Fortune 500 now controls 63% of the total U.S. gross domestic product. Now, that's a level of totalitarianism that's, remember, these are totalitarian institutions, as totalitarian as human beings have ever devised. And that's a level of totalitarian control that has very rarely been reached in the world, if ever, you might check. Among the biggest gainers are Manpower Incorporated, which hires temporary workers. Very important fact. Their profits were up 35% last year, sales up 35%, what they call sales, meaning selling people, was up 30% to undermine pampered Western workers, remember, because they're selling temporary workers, so you don't need benefits and you don't need security, you get a flexible labor market. So their sales are up 35%, they're now number 237 in the combined industry services list. Services doesn't mean guys who clean the offices. It means investment firms and banks and, you know, those guys. They're 237. Kelly, their sales are up 21%. Well, that also tells you something. These are another form of the techniques for undermining the workforce. And the workforce means the population. You know, workers means most of the population, their families, their children, and so on. Caterpillar is now number 61 in this combined industrial service list. Its profits were up 46% from 1993, and the earnings per share were up 46%. That's not small. And this is expected to continue. The May 1st issue of Fortune has a big article called Why Profits Will Keep Booming. Remember, 1993, they were dazzling. And they were even more splendid in 1994, they put it. That's the fourth successive year of double-digit growth in profits, and they expect it to go on through 1996 at least. Remember, this is a period when wages are going down and working hours are going up, okay? But profits are just dazzling. Earnings per share, they say, have doubled since 1991. The return on capital has more than doubled, considerably more than doubled, since 1980. Profit margins are up. Working hours are up. Temporary workers are way up as a proportion of the workforce. The only thing that's down is wages and benefits and working conditions. Other things are up, too, as I mentioned before, like industrial accidents have shot way up. So, you know, a lot of things are doing really good. But some things aren't doing so good, namely the pampered Western workers with their luxurious lifestyles. The Wall Street Journal, having hailed the welcome development of transcendent importance in 1992, noticed another one just a few weeks ago. They said that in 1993, the change in unit labor costs finally reached zero. There's always inflation, remember. Finally reached zero. And that stayed there since 1993. Well, it's another welcome development of transcendent importance. In fact, total labor costs last year were lower than any year since 1981. The headline reads, "Economic gains fail to increase benefits wages," which kind of understates it. So what are we supposed to do in the face of all of this? Well, we get some information from the press, too. So yesterday's New York Times had a front page story with explaining how you got to react to all this stuff. Headline was, quoted an expert as saying, "New York is simply not wealthy enough to afford services to the general population." The expert was a J.P. Morgan executive. J.P. Morgan is fifth among the banks in the 500 listing, doing rather nicely. So New York isn't wealthy enough. In fact, the country is flooded with capital. You know, it's super wealthy, but it's not wealthy enough for services to the general population because you got to increase those stunning, dazzling, stupendous profit levels that are shooting way up for like a few percent of the population. So therefore, you have the Pataki budget and the Giuliani budget and the rest of them. Cut taxes for the rich. If you look at the back pages of the New York Times, you'll notice that they mentioned that all the tax cuts are for the benefit of business. All the tax cuts are for the benefit of business. So you cut taxes for the rich. Meanwhile, you increase taxes for everyone else. But here comes some advice to those of you who want to get into the commissar class. You don't call them taxes. You call them something else. Here's what you call them. I'm quoting from the Times. You call them multi-million-dollar reductions in subsidies to the city's mass transit system and cuts in aid to education and higher education. Well, you know, you guys are MIC students. You can figure out what that means. When you cut what they call subsidies to mass transportation and to the city schools, you're increasing taxes to the people who pay for those things. That's what it amounts to. You don't call it a tax, but of course it's a tax. When the subway fares go up beyond their already astronomical level, as they do when you cut these so-called subsidies, meaning paying for services for people, using taxpayer funds for the purposes of people, that's called a subsidy. When you cut those subsidies, rates go up, the tuition rates go up for the city schools, and somebody pays those rates, namely poor people. So it's a tax, it's not called a tax, and a highly regressive tax. It's a good kind of tax, a tax that slams the poor, you know, meaning most of the population. So that's the right kind. The rich guys who ride in the limousines, they want to make sure that everybody's in the subways so they can get through New York traffic, but they don't want to have to pay for it. They want somebody else to pay for it, namely the school children who now no longer get reduced rates for rides on the subways. Well, but you don't call that a tax, remember. You've got to understand how these words work. And this goes across the board. Social policy is geared with precision, delicate precision, to have these deliberate effects. So take the idea of forcing welfare recipients to work. In fact, welfare programs in the United States are way below any other country. It's one of the most miserly countries in the world in that. Largely because we have weak unions. It correlates pretty well. And what there was has declined radically. AFDC, the one they talk about, has declined about 50% since 1970, with devastating effects on families and children and so on, as you'd imagine. But it has to go down more. The people on it, welfare mothers, they have to be driven to the workforce. There's an interesting assumption there, which nobody seems to challenge, and that is they're not working. Like, if you're raising children, that's not work, right? Like, your husband loses his job, and you got to go out to the workforce because you're not working when you're raising children. That just comes free, like everything women do. Real work is the kind of stuff that you get paid for. Remember, we live in a meritocracy. That's another thing we're taught. You live in a meritocracy, and you measure the merit of work by the amount of income that accrues to it. So real work is the kind of stuff that you do when you're in Wall Street speculating against currencies to drive down growth rates and wages. That's real work, and you can tell from the fact that in our meritocracy, you get very high pay for it. On the other hand, raising children, let's say, that's not even work at all. You don't got to pay a cent for that. In fact, you got to be driven into the workforce, which has the extra side benefit that, as everybody knows, when these people who aren't doing any work, just taking care of children, when they're driven into the workforce, they're going to have subsidized jobs because there aren't any jobs around, which means taxpayer-subsidized jobs at very low wages, which has the nice side effect of undermining union wages, so everybody's wages go down at taxpayer expense. Well, that's another part of social policy, very nicely designed, you know, not very brilliant because it's obvious, figured out pretty obviously, but that's the way it's working. And in fact, sometimes they even come clean, like the mayor of New York the other day, Mayor Giuliani, came clean finally and said exactly what everybody knew he was up to and the whole policy is up to, namely drive poor people out of New York City. He said it finally, thanks. It's pretty obvious before, but the idea is that New York City is for J.P. Morgan executives, you know, the experts who tell you we're not wealthy enough to pay for people. And the mayor was kind enough to say it, and the New York Times even had a nice headline about it. They said, welfare cuts provide a chance to leave, you know. So it's all tough love, you know. I mean, finally we're going to free up these poor people so they're not stuck here. We're going to give them a chance to leave by cutting rents and wages and, you know, money for heating your house and feeding your kids and so on. So finally you're liberated thanks to tough love. Of course, there's no tough love for Cobb County, Georgia, where Newt Gingrich comes from, or in a way there is. They're getting a $72 billion boondoggle to build F-22s to defend ourselves from countries to whom we're selling F-16s, for which we're also paying, because they might turn on us and so on. So that's another part of the system. That's why he gets more federal subsidies than any suburban county in the country outside the federal system. Well, that's the free market. I mentioned before that the attacks on the on labor during the Reagan years were criminal as they were. I guess there's not really time to talk about this, so I won't go into it. It's true, but it's misleading. Because, in fact, there has been a huge attack ever since the Wagner Act. The Wagner Act drove business berserk. They thought they had the country by the throat. Woodrow Wilson's Red Scare smashed up the unions, you know, threw the leading union leader, Eugene Debs, into jail for daring to raise some questions about the Second World War as a free country, remember. Independent thought, you know, independent action, labor movement was completely smashed. Looked like business really had everything under control. And then along came the Depression, and you had labor organizing and activism and so on and so forth. And finally along came the Wagner Act, which brought to the United States the benefits that were part of it had been achieved in Europe about half a century before. In fact, U.S. labor history is extremely violent, incomparably more so than Europe. What you saw there is nothing. I remember seeing much worse things when I was a kid and growing up in Philadelphia. And before that, it was hundreds of workers were getting murdered by the security forces. This went on in the late 1930s. Nothing like it in Europe. In fact, the right-wing European press was appalled by the treatment of American workers right through the early part of the century. This is a business-run society, and it shows. In 1935, the Wagner Act was passed, finally. Business went out of their minds. The National Association of Manufacturers Literature warned about what they called the hazard facing industrialists due to the rising political power of the masses. Unless we redirect their thinking, we're going to be headed to adversity. They started right off with a big campaign, you know, scientific methods of strike breaking, all kind of social science frauds about harmony and stuff like that. It was kind of put on hold for a while during the war, picked up right afterwards with an extraordinary campaign of corporate propaganda. It's not studied much. In fact, the first academic study of it just came out. This is one of the most important things in modern American history. Literally, the first book just came out by University of Illinois Press a couple months ago, another one in Australia. And in fact, there is an Australian scholar who's been writing about this for years. I've been writing about it mainly using his work, I should say. But an American study finally came out, and it's pretty interesting. Right after the Second World War, the business community, the country was social democratic, very social democratic at that time, and they knew it. And the business leaders said that they had to renew with vigor what they called the everlasting battle for the minds of men and indoctrinate citizens with the capitalist story. They said that we have 3 to 5 years to resell our preferred way of life. And they went after it with a vengeance. Anti-union campaigns, anti-unionism was... The idea was, as they put it, to sell anti-unionism as anti-American. Huge campaigns were undertaken, the sort of, you know, we versus them. There's us as the, you know, the sober working man and the housewife and the corporate executive slaving away for everyone's benefit. And they are those outsiders, the strikers, who are coming to try to disrupt their harmony. There was huge business about this. At that time, there was a vigorous labor press. The one-dimensional press of American society is fairly recent. There were about 800 labor newspapers back in the 1950s with tens of millions of people reading them. They were condemning the corporate media, as they put it, for damning labor at every opportunity while carefully glossing over the sins of the banking and industrial magnates who really control the nation. That had to be destroyed, of course, and the reason is that truth is subversive. It's anti-American. It has to be eliminated, and it was destroyed with a tremendous power play. This covered everything from the entertainment industry to the corporate media to the schools and so on. Billions of dollars a year were devoted to this, taking over schools, churches, recreational activities, anything you can think about. The corporate media, of course, are right in the center of it. The films were quite important, commercial films as well as propaganda films. Propaganda films were reaching 20 to 30, business propaganda was reaching 20 to 30 million people a year in the early 50s. Business was providing about a third of all school materials. This was not a small thing. On top of that, there's a whole commercial industry, like, you know, the standard depiction of unions in the movies is sort of Marlon Brando on the waterfront, you know, tough working class Joe stands up against union bosses, and you know, because that's and unions, in fact, were portrayed as something that the workers have to fight against. Just as people have to be liberated to leave New York, workers had to be freed from the oppression of the unions. And a huge amount of energy and effort was put into this. It was pretty successful. The unions tried to combat it, but they couldn't even come close. The concentration of capital was so enormous that it wasn't even a battle. This picked up again in the 1970s. There was another upsurge with foundations trying to take over the educational institutions, so, you know, Olin professorships of free enterprise and glossy right-wing student magazines, very well funded all over the place, and so on and so forth. It's had an effect. The effect has been to pretty much demolish civil society, to turn people into what is the ideal. You know, the ideal is very clear. The ideal is a completely fragmented, atomized society where everyone's totally alone, doing nothing but trying to pursue created wants, and the wants are created. It's known that they're created. Nobody wants those things. You create wants. People are stuck with their television set or, you know, their interactive, whatever it is. They're glued to this thing, and they're told what they want, and they have to want it. They don't have any connection with anyone else. You know, you don't see anybody else. You don't deal with anyone else. You're an atom of consumption. And you go to work at lower and lower wages for more and more hours and less benefits and security in a flexible labor market. That's the kind of utopia that they're looking for, and it's not very far from there. It's led to very strange effects in the country. I mean, the country is like a devastated peasant society. You know, you really have to go back to Europe and the Black Death, I think, 14th century, to find anything similar. People are scared, angry, hostile, hate everything, don't know what they hate, you know, don't have anybody else to talk to, just angry, desperate. There are cults all over the place at a scale that is unknown in any other society. I mean, you have to, the level of religious fundamentalism alone is probably the highest in the world. It's, I'm almost certain, higher than Iran, you know. And that's only one of them. You know, right now the militias happen to be on the front pages, but that's just a tiny fragment of it. And it's incidentally not the right. The left is the same, you know. It's across the board. It's just a dissolved society, very scary. The portent is ominous. You know, it's the kind of a situation, and it's a kind of a situation which is indeed reminiscent of Germany in the late 30s in a lot of ways, or Iran in the late 70s, you know. Very frightening, and it's much more frightening when it happens here. At the same time, it's a kind of an organizer's dream. You know, people, if you look at people's attitudes, they remain social democratic. Like, you know, people are overwhelmingly believe that working people ought to have more influence. They don't have enough. That the government ought to help poor people. That's its job, you know. That people are overwhelmingly opposed to things like budget balancing if, for example, it's going to cut down educational or health expenditure, and so on across the board. As I say, it doesn't matter because it's irrelevant to policy. They do what they like. But it's a situation in which the opportunities for organizing and rebuilding a democratic culture are very, very high, and it can be done, but it's certainly not going to happen by itself. You know? Going to happen the same, take the same kind of energy and activism that it's taken to lift us out of feudalism and slavery and every other horror in the past. Well, the Oklahoma City bombing, bringing the chickens home to roost, well, unfortunately, there's a little more truth to that than the press is willing to make out. Turned out in this case, you remember at the beginning they were looking for some Middle East connection, and they would have bombed anybody in sight if they'd found it. You could tell that right off. It didn't work, so you're stuck with the angry white men. And there, the source of that is quite real. They have every reason to be angry. There's a lot to be angry about. I'm assuming that the current stories are correct, that the sectors from which this is coming, there's plenty to be mad at, but I don't think people know what to be angry about. What has been created by this half century of massive corporate propaganda is what's called anti-politics. So anything that goes wrong, you blame the government. Well, okay, there's plenty to blame the government about, but the government is the one institution in which that people can change. It's the one institution you can affect by participation without institutional change, right? That's exactly why all the anger and fear is directed against the government. The government has a defect. It's potentially democratic. Corporations have no defect. They're pure tyrannies. So therefore, you want to keep corporations invisible and focus all anger on the government. So you don't like something, you know, your wages are going down, blame the government, you know. Not blame the guys in the Fortune 500 because you don't read the Fortune 500, you know, thing. You just read what they tell you in the newspapers. So you don't read about the dazzling profits and the stupendous this and the wages going down and so on. All you know is that the bad government's doing something, so let's get mad at the government. As I say, plenty to be mad about the government, but the government is exactly what Dewey described it as. It's the shadow cast by business over society. You want to change something, change the substance, not the shadow. And everyone contributes to this, including the Democrats. They're deeply committed to it. You take a look at the Clinton campaign literature. it's like, you know, it's a public, I don't know what public relations firm wrote it, but whatever one did it understands their business. The thing that they were giving out at the drugstores, you know, 10 cents for on their mandate for change, as they called it, incidentally a slogan that they borrowed from Eisenhower, which shows how much change they contemplated. The first chapter of it was called Entrepreneurial Economics, and that was their big economic program. I explained how we're not old-fashioned liberals, you know, who believe in entitlements and getting children food to eat and that sort of thing. We're interested in entrepreneurial economics. And then they go on to describe it. And it's very, read it carefully, very interesting to see how the mind of the commissar works, you know, the really skilled propagandist, guys who get trained in the good universities. The way it works is like this. Entrepreneurial economics involves workers and their firms. It's all about workers and their firms. You know, anybody who works in a firm can tell you how much it's their firms. So there's workers and their firms, and then there's the government, which is going to try to help out the workers and their firms. There's a couple of words that don't appear in it, like profits, you know, bosses, managers. They're not investors, banks. They don't appear. It's just the workers and their firms. There are entrepreneurs. Who have a kind of a shadowy existence. They're sort of nice guys who live in the Sloan School or somewhere, and every once in a while they come around and they sort of help out the workers in their firms, and then they kind of disappear somewhere. And that's the economic, that's entrepreneurial economics. Well, okay, you know, that's the kind of thing you're taught to do in good universities, to put things that way. And that's the Democrats. Now, when you got that on one side, and on the other side, you got, you know, hate the government because they're responsible for everything and its taxes and the pointy-headed bureaucrats in Washington, but not the ones in the insurance offices, you end up with a mood of what is called anti-politics. And anti-politics is a very scary phenomenon. It can take the form of that it is taking, you know, forming what shouldn't be called militias, because remember, militias are things raised by states. These are just private armies, forming private armies to defend the country, the people against, you know, the UN forces being brought in the black helicopters by the Council on Foreign Relations to commit genocide or whatever story you like. Or else it's, you know, fight against Lucifer and Beast 66 who's doing this, that, and the other thing. And that's what, if you take a look across the country, that's what people are worried about and fighting against. Aliens, you know, the devil, the UN forces, the Federal Reserve. I mean, everything except what's real, namely private tyranny, private corporate power, the guys who are listed in the Fortune 500. Well, that's an achievement. That's a propaganda achievement. And while the anger and the fear is real and it's based on something and you got to sympathize with it because it is real, when your wages have dropped 25% roughly in, say, 15 years, and, you know, your wife has to work and your kids can't eat and so on and so forth, and you have no future and everything's rotten, you have a lot to be angry about. But people are not focused on what's doing it. That's the difference between the days in which there was a live, functioning labor movement that was organizing these people, exactly these people, to work together to change things.
That was Professor Noam Chomsky speaking on class war. Thanks to AK Press in San Francisco for that tape.